This week on Restore It All, we've got one of the founders of the company that created M-Disc. That's the optical storage product that can hold data for 1,000 years. He talks about why they made it and how in the world they're able to make that claim. I hope you enjoy the episode. You could restore. Hi, and welcome to Backup Central's Restore It All podcast. I'm your host, W. Curtis Preston, a.k.a. Mr. Backup. And I have with me, as always, the guy who's doing a really poor job of talking me out of buying a Tesla, Persona Malianti. How's it going, Persona?
I'm good, Curtis. Now, to be fair, I never talked you into buying it.
I told you that your job was to talk me out of buying a Tesla.
Yeah. Well, I think it's for reasons that you want, right? Where you want to try some new technology. It could make sense. Plus, I know that you've been also a little stressed about your car that you currently drive.
Yeah, there's that. It's not sure how long it's going to be. And also I'm getting a case of FOMO because I got a new car for my wife. So, you know, maybe it's just not, it's not FOMO. It's just,
it is a bit of, well, it's only jealousy and FOMO if you never get to steal the car from her, you know?
Yeah. I'm sure she'll get many more miles on it than I will.
Yeah. Or you should tell her, by the way, it's about 6 weeks delayed. Don't worry about it. It'll eventually be.
Yeah. Well, honey, sorry. The car is not going to be here. It's
delayed. They had an issue with shipping. I'm sorry. But and yeah, don't worry about that new car that's in their driveway. It's totally fine. It's someone else's car. Don't know who's that.
Why does my new car have 10,000 miles on
it? Oh, Curtis.
That would be the Tesla is like a LTO tape drive. Like it costs a lot to get into it, but then the media is cheap.
Yeah, that is probably true.
Yeah, it's a little bit like that.
I can't believe you just made a reference to LTO tape with the Tesla.
Yeah.
I can see people like turning over and watch. Elon Musk is now going to tweet you. I cannot believe you compared.
Yeah. I think Elon paying any attention to me is highly unlikely, but you know, we'll see.
So for our listeners, if you feel like you want to get Elon to respond to Curtis about this, please tag him on Twitter along with Curtis, and let's see if we can get Elon to respond.
Yeah, good luck with that. That wouldn't hurt the listenership of the podcast, I'm sure. But so I compared a Tesla to an LTO tape drive, and I think it's a pretty good comparison. But speaking of inexpensive media, we have an exciting guest today. We have talked about MDisc before. Our guest today is a full professor at BYU, having been there since 1992, also having taught at Utah State and Snow College. Prior to that, he was a design engineer for IBM in Arizona. He is one of two co-founders of MDisc, which we have talked about on this podcast a couple times. Welcome to the podcast, Barry Lunt.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you guys today.
So,
but before you get into
what
Barry, would you say Curtis's analogy was accurate?
Oh, you want me to opine on that? Well, actually, I quite liked it. I think there are some similarities there.
And like LTO, Tesla has a lot of haters.
Yep.
There's a lot of people that like it, you know, and the people that like tape, you know, and people that like, you know what, it's like MDisc, right? There are people that are big fans of MDisc, and then there are people that just, well, I don't think MDisc really has any haters. I think there's some non-believers, and I think for sure. We can talk about that. And so we've covered MDisc. Persona, do you have episode names and numbers?
Yes, we covered MDisc in... Let's see. Episode 160 is MDIS, the ultimate archive medium for SMB and home users. So yeah. Go take a listen. That was kind of Curtis and my take on MDIS based on information that Daniel Rosehill had shared with us. Because Barry, like Curtis was saying, you kind of have the people who love MDIS and you kind of have the haters who may not be there. I think there's actually a third group, which is probably a significant group of people who don't even know MDIS exists.
Well, I think that's the biggest group. And I was in that group.
Yeah.
Up until,
both of us were.
Yeah. Up until Daniel. I mean, at this point, you know, my day job is one of doesn't have anything to do with optical media. I should probably throw out our usual disclaimer. Prasanna and I both work for different companies. He works for Zoom. I work for Druva. This is not a podcast of either company, not sponsored by them or anything like that. The opinions that you hear are ours. If you would like to join us on the podcast, please do so. Just reach out to me at WC Preston on Twitter or WCurtisPreston at Gmail. Also, please rate us at ratethispodcast.com/restore. So thanks to Daniel, which is, he calls himself a term I hadn't even heard before, backup anorak. We had him on the podcast and he turned us on to MDiscs. So what I'd like to, so first let's just do a quick, you know, summary of how you would describe MDisc today.
How I would describe it?
Yes. He's never heard of, they know what a DVD is, right? Or they know what a Blu-ray is, but they don't know what MDisc is. So how would you describe that in, you know, relatively shortly?
Yeah. So if you die and 1,000 years from now, your descendants want to learn something about you and they find this something up in the attic, if it's digital, which everything is today, it will have nothing on it. All digital media degrades with time, and in 1,000 years, it will have nothing on it except for the MDisc. The MDisc will still be readable, and we suspect that people will have a way to read the disc because it's easy today, it's cheap. In 1,000 years, I can't imagine that would be difficult. So the data that was recorded 1,000 years ago will still be there.
And so it is an optical medium. But it's different than the other optical mediums. How?
It is different in what we call the recording layer. You know, you have polycarbonate, which is the base material for the optical disc, and then you put a layer of material there that is light sensitive, so that you can use a laser to actually change the nature of that material and record your ones and zeros. Most of the all optical discs except for the MDisc use a recordable dye, and that dye is organic, which means that it degrades with time. And of course, it has to be light sensitive, which means if you put it in the light's going to erase it relatively quickly within a matter of years, depending on how intense the light. Ours is only light sensitive in that it absorbs light, but it's like stone. It's like using a laser to etch pictures in stone. Once they're there, you cannot remove them. You have to physically destroy the disc in order to remove the data. It cannot be re-recorded.
So basically all the CDs, DVDs that I have in my closet from things that I've burned, they're probably useless now because they were burned probably like 20 years ago.
Yes. If you burn them, it's highly likely that the data is not there. Now, if you buy them in the store, they're not recordable discs, meaning the data has already been recorded and it's recorded on them by a very different method. It's a stamping method. And then we deposit a metal reflective layer on top of that. And that's very permanent. The NIST did some studies and they showed that it has a lifetime of about 1,500 years on these permanently stamped discs. So that's good, but you can't record those yourself.
We brought you on to talk about the MDisc, but the only, if I want to call it competing, there is something that I've heard about. People talk about an archive quality DVD. What do you know about that?
Quite a bit. We did a lot of studies when Millenniata was a going enterprise, and we did a whole lot of studies that I've published on the comparison between those. And of course, the Naval Weapons Research Center did an independent study for us because they were concerned about storing data for a long time. And they published their results independent of the company. And basically, they looked at the very top archival quality recordable optical discs and compared them to the MDisc, and ours won out by a long, long, long ways. All of theirs died during the test. Ours actually slightly improved. We don't claim that it improved because we can't see how it could, but our disc did not get worse at all.
How would you improve it? Because if it, you know, I would assume that it's like 100%. That's like baseline. So how do you improve from that?
That's a really good question. Digital data is, you know, we like to think of it as ones and zeros. And when you read it back, we turn it into ones and zeros. But in reality, what you do is you change the optical properties of the disc. So in some places it reflects well, in other places it doesn't. And we call those ones and zeros. Well, it turns out that every time you read data back, no matter what you store it on, hard disks, optical disks, LTO tapes, whatever you or flash drives, whatever you store it on, when you read it back, it doesn't come out perfect. And so we fix that on the fly using what we call error correction coding. Well, we can simply look at those errors as they come in and see them before they're fixed. So clearly, if I have 20 errors and a competing disk has 50 errors, then mine's better, but they're both correctable. And therefore, in the end, they wind up with zero errors because they're all correctable errors. But eventually, you reach a point where there are too many errors and you no longer can correct the model. And so the disk fails to read correctly. But that's how we assess the quality of the data, is looking at the errors before they're corrected.
Gotcha.
That makes sense.
Yeah, that does. That's how you get better than 100%. Because that's right. Because 100% really isn't 100%. That's the way error correcting stuff. And I think the average IT person understands that, but which that's generally our audience, but I don't think the average consumer gets that at all.
No.
But I look at things like this, especially something new like this. I mean, it's new to me. I know it's been around. How long has it been around?
2008.
Yeah. So a while. Right. I can't believe that it's literally half of my backup career. It's been out and I hadn't heard of it until Daniel. But again, I spent most of my time in tape and then went into disc. And in the world where I live in, the idea of a device that can only hold, a certain number of gigabytes, not very exciting. The other problem historically with the areas where I typically did backup and recovery, there's a couple. One of the big ones is throughput, right? And optical has never been very sexy when it comes to throughput, right?
No, it has not.
Yeah, great on long-term archiving, but not so much in throughput.
What made you want to create MDisc, Barry? Like, what was sort of the reason behind it?
Yeah, I love telling this story. In 2005, I was thinking about my pictures, and of course, if you back up about 30 years, people thought pictures were very, very valuable because you'd pay for the roll of film, you'd print them off, and you'd put them in a photo book, and people always said, if my house is on fire, the first thing I'm going to do is get my children out, and then number two, my photo albums, because they were very valuable. Well, that's how I felt about digital pictures when I first started getting them, and that was about 2005, and so I had a hard drive full of them, and I knew the hard drives are prone to catastrophic failure. And so I thought, okay, what should I back it up onto? I thought about optical discs. I knew that they didn't last a long time. I thought about flash drives. I knew they weren't permanent. And I thought about magnetic tape, and I didn't have really a good option there because getting into it, it's a bit on the expensive side. And I knew that there was nothing permanent. I thought, gee, if I care about storing my pictures for a long time, I'm sure I'm not the only person in the world who does. Wouldn't it be nice if we had a permanent digital data storage medium? So that's when I remembered, I've seen petroglyphs. I had taken my son and a bunch of other 16, 17-year-old scouts down to a place called Nine Mile Pass, about an hour and a half from where I live, to do some camping. And while there, we looked at some petroglyphs made by the Fremont Indians hundreds, perhaps thousands of years ago, still visible today. And I realized that they were made by a process different than what I understood. That is, they're etched. The outside layer of the rock is dark from the exposure to the weather for centuries and millennia. And then they just took some sharp object and etched away that top layer and exposed a light layer. And that's optical contrast. And I thought, well, that's how optical discs are made. You have light spots and dark spots. And then I thought, well, we could use an optical disc and put a rock-like media on it, dark, and then ablate it with a laser and have dark spots and light spots and record data permanently. And so I thought, wow, that's cool. So that's when I started visiting with my chemistry friend, Matt Lentford, And he and I said, yeah, we think this is worth researching. Let's do it. And then a couple of years later, we found a couple of the guys that were interested in starting a company, Henry O'Connell and Doug Hansen. And that's when we started Millenniata. So that was about 2005, 2006 that we started the enterprise.
Coming into this, like from the back end, like by the time I find about MDisk, the M in MDisk isn't around anymore. So I was like, I was confused. And, you know, how is this, you know, I mean, I've since learned the answers to that question. So the company, as I understand it, the company itself didn't succeed, but the medium did. Is that a fair summary?
That is, yes. In the process of the many different things that the company tried in order to stay afloat, they licensed the production of the media to Verbatim. And Verbatim has continued to produce the MDisk. And so as far as I'm aware, they're the only company that produces it today under license from the company Millenniata.
Gotcha. How is that different than, because my understanding is that the original company isn't around anymore. Is that not a correct understanding?
Yeah, that is correct. The company is not around anymore. It went into receivership a few years ago. And
okay.
So we don't have any proceeds. But at the time, we were making the discs ourselves, and Verbatim was also making them.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, gotcha.
So basically, they have the IP to make the technology, right?
Because we licensed it to them, right?
So we talk about the media, right, Barry? But that's like only half the equation, right? How do you get things onto that media, right? I guess is like a critical aspect. And I know we were talking or joking earlier about Tesla comparing it to LTO tape drives, right? And the cost being so high up front. What does MDisk require in order to actually be able to use the media?
Wow, that's a pretty deep question, but I suppose our technical audience is ready for something like that. In order to record a one and a zero on the disk, you have to turn on the laser at a certain intensity, leave it on for a certain amount of time, and then finish. And it's not a question of just turning it on and off. You have to do a start and then an end, what we call a castle. So you have to get the media to ablate. The recording layer has to be ablated. You have to start it. And then you have to continue ablating it, but then you have to stop it so that you get a mark that is consistent in length. Let's say that I want three ones. Well, my four ones needs to be exactly 33% longer than my three ones, exactly. The same is true for my two ones, needs to be 33% smaller. And to get those marks to be there consistently is extremely difficult. And when we don't do it well, we get what we call jitter, which is variation in the time domain, which means we get errors, bit errors. It increases our bit error rate.
Which is the last thing you want for like a disk you're going to keep for 1,000 years, right?
Clearly, you want extremely low bit errors. So we just had to work with developing what we call a write strategy. Well, the write strategy, it turns out, for the DVD had to be unique. And so we had to develop it. And then we had to include that write strategy in the drives that recorded and read back the DVD. Well, when we developed the Blu-ray version of the MDisk, it turns out that one of the right strategies for one of the various types of media for the Blu-ray version already worked for ours. So we didn't have to have a different kind of drive.
Oh, nice.
So originally, yeah, you had that special drive for the DVD, but for the Blu-ray, you didn't have to. And so now you can record on any MDisk with the right DVD drive, but you can record on any Blu-ray MDisk with any drive. And then, of course, the good news is, once they're recorded, you can read them on any DVD player or any Blu-ray player in the world.
Wow. So that, because unlike LTO tape drives, right, where you have to, I know, Curtis, you've talked about, yes, you need a certain type and make sure it's compatible and all the rest. It looks like with MDisk, it's pretty much anything, as long as it can read a Blu-ray, should be able to at least read that disk.
Typically, not even all writable DVD and Blu-ray media were always readable in all drives. But you're saying this one is? And by the way, my information on that is a little out of date, but you're saying no problem here.
No problem. There are plenty of read strategies, and the read strategies all work with the MDisk, thankfully.
Okay. So, and this does bring up a related question, though, because when I was researching this, so again, you know, go big or go home. I was looking at the 100 gigabyte disks, right? And I was like, just interesting, based on the application I might use it, I might not need the 100 gigabyte disk, right? Because it is a write once. By the way, I can keep appending, right?
You can keep appending until the disk is full. You can keep appending.
Okay. So I found an incredibly inconsistent verbiage on various Blu-ray drives as to whether or not they supported the larger medium. Do you think, like, it would all Blu-ray drives support the larger medium, or do I have to find a specific one that would support that?
You would have to have a specific one that supports that. My understanding is that the Blu-ray standard is 25 gigabytes per layer. You can get two layers per side of the disc, and you can get a two-sided disc, which gives you four layers total. But that means you have to have a drive that supports the two layers. And then, of course, you have to turn the media over in order to access the other side. I don't believe there's a Blu-ray drive that has read and write heads on both sides of the disc.
So a 100 gigabyte disc is really 250 gigabyte disc, is what I'm hearing. Okay.
Yeah.
So I guess it makes it a little less cool. I thought it was a 100 gigabyte disc. What it really is a two-sided 50 gigabyte disc, right?
Yes.
Or 250. And my guess is that's no different than like Blu-rays itself, right?
It probably isn't.
Not at all. That's the Blu-ray standard.
It wasn't immediately obvious to me. Yeah. I'm sure one or two of the listeners are like rolling their eyes now. Like, Curtis, you're so stupid.
Well, I remember I was having a Twitter chat message thread with Daniel about this. And he was saying, because he lives in Israel, right, that getting the higher density discs is actually a lot more expensive. And so he's like, yeah, I basically ended up, I think it goes, what, 5, 25, and 100, I think.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the size of those, he's like, yeah, I got like the middle one because that was just the cheapest per gigabyte cost for right now.
Yeah. What I found for me acquiring it via, you know, my favorite South American themed internet retailer is that it was generally about the same, like in terms of dollars per gigabyte. So it was just buy what you thought worked for you. And obviously, depending on which supplier you go with, right? But but I was frustrated on the whole support for the 100 gigabyte thing. So really what it is, what you're saying, Barry, is it's support for the 50 gigabyte is the thing that makes it, because like you said, the Blu-ray standard is 25.
That's right.
Right. Okay. Gotcha. So my research will continue. You know, it's interesting. You know, I heard your story, the origin story, if you will, of M-Disc. I know what happens when you assume, but I assumed that, you know, I'm guessing you're LDS. You work for BYU. I figured there was an LDS angle to this. Because I know that the church is big on preservation and all of that sort of stuff. So I concocted in my head a completely different origin story. Is there any connection to your university?
Not really. There's an obtuse connection in that we felt that the church might be one of our early customers. As you mentioned, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints really does care a great deal about storing things permanently,
right,
with their granite vaults in the Little Cottonwood Canyon up in Salt Lake and so forth. But they don't use unproven technology. They only use something that has been proven and been around for a long time. And, of course, the M-Disc, of course, was not proven at the time. We don't know if it's been adopted. At least to our knowledge, it has not been adopted by the church. But no, it wasn't initiated by the church. We just knew that they might be an early customer.
It was kind of hopes.
We were hoping.
So that's an interesting aspect, by the way, because, you know, the conversations that I've had on Reddit with what I'll call randos, to borrow a name from or a word from the younger generation, random people on Reddit. There are those that when they hear about, in this case, MDisc being rated for 1,000 years, when they hear about tape being rated for 30 years, when they hear about Blu-ray being rated for whatever, they all understand that, that's via, you know, advanced aging technology. Obviously MDisc wasn't invented 1,000 years ago and it hasn't been tested for 1,000 years since most people haven't participated in advanced aging techniques. You know, maybe help us understand that part of it a little bit.
Yeah, I love to talk about that. My chemistry friend, Matt Linford, is one that's even stronger in this area, but he has helped me make sure I understand relatively well. So let's back up a few decades to where paint is being used nationwide, primarily here in this country. And various companies are saying, well, our paint is better than your paint. Well, how do you know that it's better? Well, okay, let's take a surface and let's paint it with our paint and your paint, and then let's abuse it. Well, how is paint abused? What causes paint to degrade? Well, we know that sunshine and rain and temperature variation, all of those are pretty tough on paint. So let's put it in a chamber where we put bright lights on it, we raise the temperature and lower the temperature and put rain on it, and then let's test it. Well, that's fun and that's cool, but how do we tie a science to it? Well, the really good thing is this guy named Arrhenius and another guy named Eyring both came up with equations that tell us exactly what the degree of degradation is as a function of the materials being used and how that relates to real time. So let's say that I degrade something in 20 hours of this abusive testing. What does 20 hours of abusive testing mean? So all we have to do really is identify what kinds of factors cause the recording layer of the MDisc to degrade. We already knew enough about polycarbonate, and we know what causes polycarbonate to degrade. So that means that if we put ultraviolet light on the and regular light on the disc and the recording layer, if we put it in temperature, high temperature, and high humidity, we know exactly how much degradation will cause 1,000 years of degradation. That's accelerated aging. It's a science that was developed by the paint industry, and now it's been extended, of course, to all sorts of industries, including optical discs.
Interesting. So you're basically just sort of borrowing it. By the way, I had no idea that it started with the paint industry. I had no idea.
So that's what the Naval Weapons Research Center did down in China Lake, California. They had this chamber, and the chamber had a lot of bright lights, and it had temperature control and humidity. So they put all the discs in there, including ours, and including the very best optical discs, and this tortured them under very carefully controlled conditions, and then tested them, put them on a reader, see what the error rate, what happened to the error rate. And of course, you watch those error rates climb and climb and climb on all the other discs until they completely failed when they were no longer correctable, where our disc was just going, hey, this is nice. This is like a walk on the beach.
Interesting. A walk on a very hot beach, but
a very hot, very intensely lit beach, but nevertheless, no problem.
So after they did all this testing, do you know if there are other government agencies or other groups who are using MDisc for their archival media?
At one time, I know the Library of Congress was looking at it, and I also know that all senators and all congressmen were given an MDisc drive so that they could record things on them.
I'll give the good and the bad, right? So the good is this all sounds great, right? And I'll give the bad, and then I'm going to go back to the good. The bad is that, you know, this combination of things that we said earlier of like the business aspect of it, right? Like what would happen tomorrow if verbatim's like, you know what, we've been making this for, you know, X number of years now, and there's only three guys that are buying it. There's some guy named Daniel out in Israel. He keeps buying a bunch of copies, and then nobody else is buying this thing. We're just going to stop making it. So that's the worry. I do understand the good is that doesn't mean that because of you know how it was designed, that doesn't mean that what you've done is in any way degraded, right? You will continue to be able to read any MDisc that you've written. I'd say that the only worry would be that you would get enthused about something that then might be suddenly snatched away.
Stockpile, but, Curtis. Stockpile.
Yeah, but if there are large governmental or you know commercial concerns that are in any way using MDISC, I would think that that would. And none of that was really a question, Barry. I don't know how you want to comment on that.
We would love to have had large customers using large quantities of disks, and I know at one time one company was developing an optical disk cabinet that would store thousands of optical disks, and they would be what we call cold storage. So you store it on them and then just keep it there for a long time. So, but that apparently didn't catch on. And so we've never found a large single entity that purchased large quantities of the MDISC.
I was thinking just about like Daniel's use case, right? He had a very specific use case where he's like, hey, I'm creating all these videos. I need to store them somewhere. I can't upload it to the cloud because my internet sucks and it's too expensive, right? And MDISC is one of those things that he sort of latched onto and sort of educated us on. I'm just wondering, are there other people who just don't know it exists? Going back to the initial thing we were talking about, right? Those three groups, right? It just seems there are a lot of people who don't know it exists. And the fact that it's not really that expensive to start using it either. Right?
Yeah, that's a great question too. And I attended a number of conferences that were related to archival. So the archival, for like eight years, I believe I presented papers at the archival conferences, two different ones. And you meet people there who care a great deal about storing things for a long time. And all of them are concerned about the fact that digital data is not something that they can store permanently. They all have what they call cycles. So they'll take it and copy it onto something new. And so they're always refreshing it, putting on a new media type, just because that's the only way to keep it persistent. And a number of the times that I went there, they would say, well, there's one exception, and that's the MDISC, but we don't know much about it. And their studies, they're being millenniatas, and of course, we have a vested interest in bragging about ourselves, and so you have to doubt our validity. That's the perspective anyway. They say, well, they themselves say that it lasts 1,000 years plus, and they do cite this one study by an independent agency, the Nuclear Weapons Research Center, but who knows? And so most of the response that I got was, well, we don't know enough about the MDISC. We haven't seen a proven track record. And in the meantime, we know we have processes that allow us to preserve our data for the next 5 years, and so we're okay.
But as your data keeps growing, though, it's like at some point copying forward that data every time, you're going to spend all your time with your tape drive just moving data from one to another rather than actually backing up anything new.
Then you're exactly right, Prasanna.
Yeah, I mean, I think you might be being a little hard on the tape and optical folks that aren't MDISC. When I hear you talking about like optical dying after 10 years, the MDISC is good for 1,000 years. Well, they say that optical is good for a whole lot longer than you're talking about, right? And LTO tape, for example, rated for 30 years, right? Not disc, right? Disc is a different problem, and certainly not solid state, but,
I want to say something about those numbers. When they rate life expectancy, they almost always are giving you the maximum, the best life expectancy. They're not giving you the mean, and they're not giving you the minimum. And so what you hear is them bragging about their media. Well, of course they would do that. But we're saying that our shortest life expectancy is 1,000 years. In other words, you won't have problems until 1,000 years. Let me cite a study that I did back in 2012, published at a conference. So this is a published optical disc life expectancy, a field report from the ISOM-ODS 2011. That's the International Symposium of Optical Media and Optical Data Storage. And what we did was we studied a total of 26,500 optical discs stored by two different libraries, and these are recorded professionally by these libraries and then stored in optical storage boxes in a temperature and humidity controlled environment. So these are non-circulating discs. You can't check them out. They're backup purposes only. And what we did is we checked and looked at what is the percent of files that can't be read on these disks, brand new versus 5 years and 3 to 7 years out and so forth. We had some that were 3 years old and some that were up to 14 years old. And here's the bottom line. 2% of the files per year are starting to fail. So every year you lose 2% more of your files. So that's with the very best optical quality, archival quality optical disk in, stored in pristine, absolute best controlled conditions. We're losing 2% per year of our files.
Just to make sure I understand, this is not something that would be caught or fixed by error correction.
These files that were unreadable had so many errors that they couldn't be read.
That is shocking, but I'd love to take a look at that study. Maybe we can do another episode on, because that is certainly does not match what the optical. And I assume that you've done a similar study with MDisk?
We've not had a library that has used the MDisk for 14 years. No, we've not done a similar study with the MDisk.
Okay. It would be a very interesting study to do.
I know it's probably not a good sample size, but given that MDisk has been around for a while now, have you actually gone back and looked at those very first MDisks that were burned, if you will, to look at to see what the error rates look like?
Well,
if at all.
What a good question. Yeah, we would love to do that. I no longer have the funds to do that kind of research because a company was funding my research.
Yeah.
I don't have a company anymore. Yeah. So no, I've not done that, but I would love to.
Gotcha. It's interesting. The verbiage that you said that the conferences that they go to, that you went to, and they said, there's this one company, Millenniata, that said, but we don't know much about that, but we know what we have and we know what we need to do. And we have a process built around that. Right. And cause that matches a lot. So another guy that's been on the podcast, Jeff Rocklin. So we had him on here about how Hollywood archives data. And I happened to be in his, he was head of IT for Disney Feature Animation. And I was in his data center when they were archiving Dinosaur, I believe was the movie. And they chose to archive onto DVD, but not Blu-ray, which was available at the time because it was a new unproven technology, right?
Okay.
And by the way, that's a lot of DVDs. Those are 4.7 gigabytes, right? That is a lot of DVDs. He had this like, it was a robotic DVD, machine that he could basically, somebody's job was to put in all these DVDs and then wait for the export to finish. And then they would take all those DVDs and put them out. And now what I'm hearing you say is, that was only like 15 years ago, and that stuff's probably degraded to the point,
2% per year. Yep.
2% per year. To be honest, did we need to save 100% of Dinosaur? Anyway.
Oh, no. Not at all, Curtis. I guess for people who want to get access to MDisks and the drives, right, is it just a matter of looking up where Verbatim sells their MDisk, purchasing in whatever the appropriate size they're looking for, and just making sure they have a compatible Blu-ray drive?
Yes.
It seems pretty straightforward. And I did quite a bit of research on Amazon. And there was no shortage of vendors that were selling MDisk capable Blu-ray drives. The only challenge I found was in finding ones that had the 100 gigabyte or the 50 gigabyte stamp on them. So now that I understand that 100 gigabyte is really just 50 gigabyte flipped over, I don't know how much that will affect my research. Cause there were a lot that said 50 gigabyte, I thought.
Yes.
I'm sure your answer to this will probably be, I have no idea how to answer that question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. There are some people out there that have, that are using the M-Disc, and that they were critical of some of the Blu-ray drives that write to it. And it's like, well, what would make a good drive versus a bad drive when writing to M-Disc? Do you have any idea what that might be?
Oh, yes. Unfortunately, there's quite a bit of variation in how the write strategy works on the laser. The interface between the laser and the media itself can cause quite a bit of variation because there's movement of the head, both laterally and vertically. And then, of course, the media is not always 100% consistent across the surface of the disc. So you're going to have areas where the laser works more effectively or less effectively. And so you wind up with what we call headroom. Headroom is the distance between how well a disc operates without failing and how perfect it could be if everything worked perfectly. That's the headroom that you have to work with. So you always want a disc that works yet has room for improvement, fewer errors, in other words. And that is all a function of the physics of the recording process. But as soon as you get below that headroom, you're suddenly starting to run out of room, and now you're recording with so many errors that you will not be able to read it back with 100% corrected errors.
But I'm not sure. Maybe you heard a different question than the one I thought I asked, but because I don't think that's an answer to the question I thought I was asking.
Sorry about that.
That's fine. I'm talking about the drives themselves. Like, what would make a good Blu-ray drive versus a not as good Blu-ray drive? And I,
for someone looking to purchase a drive, how can they figure out which one to buy?
Because the price difference is, like, there are $40 drives that do M-Disc. There are $150 drives that do M-Disc. What's the difference between a $40 Blu-ray drive and a $150 Blu-ray drive? Marketing?
Okay. I clearly did not answer the question you asked, and I apologize.
Okay.
So the answer to that is I would have to test the drives myself. I would have to take a bunch of standard media and record on each of the drives and then see what my error rate is in the readback. Because you're right. I can't tell. When I look at the brand, I can say, well, that's a reputable brand. Is this brand $150 versus $60? Is it worth that much more? I don't know. And until I do an analysis of the discs that it writes and look at how many errors there are on that disc when I read it back, I won't know the difference. Yeah. But is it possible that a $160 drive will have fewer errors when I read it back than a $40 drive? Yes, it's possible. But can I say that? No, not without testing.
And then I think the other challenge will be quality control too, right? Because that $160 drive, right? You might have a batch that looks amazing and someone else buys the exact same one and they just got a crummy batch. And so now you get more error rate or bit errors than before.
Bit errors, exactly.
All right. Well, my research continues. It's been fascinating, Barry. I'm encouraged and excited about this medium. It's new to me, so I want to call it a new medium. It's not that new. And, you know, I have the same concern that you do, right? The same concern that started the creation of M-Disc. I think about it all the time. I think about how that, you know, we used to get a box of letters, you know, from an attic somewhere, and you learn about stuff from somebody from 100 years ago. There are no boxes of letters anymore. That's gone, right?
It's gone. But,
right. That's just not going to happen unless somebody hands over the password to my Gmail account or something, right? But and assuming my Gmail account is around in 10 years, but the photos are a real thing. We really don't as the current society is so, we're so used to very reliable pieces of technology until I drop it, of course.
Or wash it.
Or wash it. Shut up, Persona. You don't know what you're talking about. I'm on my second set of AirPods here, by the way, due to a little trip in the wash. We don't, as a society, just, we don't do a good job of preserving the stuff that used to all automatically be preserved for us. right? I think if you want to start going down the route of properly preserving, even just for yourself, properly preserving important photos and videos that you think you would like to have in 20 years, I can't think of a better way to do that than MDisc. You know,
they will be there. The disc will have the data. Right. I like to tell other people that say, well, the cloud's a solution. Well, the cloud is a very nice solution as long as you continue to pay your annual subscription fee. But when you die, they don't preserve it because they love you. They preserve it because you pay them. So once you stop paying them, they will not preserve your data. It's not going to be there.
No, it's not going to happen. Well, Barry, thanks. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Curtis. Thank you, Prasanna. It's been great to visit with you both.
And thanks, Prasanna. Do you think we covered this all right this week?
I think we did a good job, and thank you, Barry, for answering our questions. Honestly, at this point, I'm like, I have a bunch of things, pictures and other important stuff sitting on discs and other things. I'm like, maybe I should go pick up an MDisc drive and some media. Curtis, when you finish your research, just tell me what you buy so I can buy the same thing. It makes it easier.
Well, I'm going to buy 10. Apparently, that's what I need to do. I'm going to buy 10 Blu-ray drives. And then I,
you know, an easier solution for this?
What?
We should just ask Daniel what he bought, because I bet you he did the research. And
I bet you you are right. But if I know Daniel, he probably bought the $150 drive. Yeah. Anyway. All right. Well, thank you very much to the listeners. We'd be nothing without you. Be sure to subscribe so that you can restore it all.